pushing for laws that make sure that at least some of the wealth under the ground ends up in the hands of the people living above it. And right now, we know that the biggest disease of all is not a disease. It's corruption. But there's a vaccine for that too. It's called transparency, open data sets. Something the TED community is really on it. Daylight, you could call it. Transparency. And technology is really turbocharging this. It's getting harder to hide if you're doing bad stuff.
U2 frontman Bono giving a TED talk on inequality in 2013. Bono has famously used his celebrity to fight poverty with his One campaign. Well, now he is one of the many wealthy individuals who've been named in the Paradise Papers. It is a trove of millions of leaked documents that show how some rich people and multi-billion-dollar corporations use offshore companies to avoid paying taxes. The papers reveal that President Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross invested in a shipping company with ties to the Kremlin. They show how Apple shifted billions of dollars to the Channel Islands to avoid a tax crackdown in Ireland. And that's just a few of the stories to come out of these documents. Mike McIntyre is one of the nearly 400 journalists around the world who've been digging into the Paradise Papers. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, these papers come from this law firm based in Bermuda. It's called Appleby, not to be confused with the restaurant chain. Tell us about this firm and what it does exactly.
Well, Appleby is one of many law firms that specialize in providing offshore tax avoidance schemes for wealthy people around the world and multinational companies. If you recall, the Panama Papers a couple of years ago was a similar leak that came from a law firm in Panama. This one's a little bit different in that Appleby has what you might call a, you know, they consort with a higher class of clients, if you will. These are sort of a, you know, tax avoidance clients that are operating at a different level from what we saw in Panama, in the sense that the law firm in Panama really kind of catered in some cases to clients that were very sketchy, and some of the stuff bordered on illegality or fraud. Here, it's really, what's interesting about it is not so much any kind of criminal allegations, but rather it's what is entirely legal that they're getting away with.
So let's say I'm someone like Bono. Let's say I'm Bono, and I've got tons of money, and I need to put it somewhere. What do I do? I contact Appleby, and then what happens?
Well, Appleby is a law firm, but it's also a financial services firm. And so what it does is it specializes in creating offshore corporate and partnership vehicles that wealthy people and companies use to essentially funnel their money offshore, I mean literally to in this case Bermuda, where it escapes taxation. Now these corporate entities that they create are not all in Bermuda. The law firm is there, but they specialize in creating things in the Cayman Islands, in Luxembourg, in the Netherlands, and as you mentioned earlier, in the Channel Islands. So wherever there is a tax advantage offered by a country, Appleby is prepared to help you, you know, take advantage of it.
Okay. Speaking of the Channel Islands, that's where Apple has decided to park a lot of its profits. And I want to just play a clip of tape from a few years ago. Tim Cook here, the CEO of Apple, testifying before the Senate.
We pay all the taxes we owe, every single dollar. We not only comply with the laws, but we comply with the spirit of the laws. We don't depend on tax gimmicks. We don't move intellectual property offshore and use it to sell our products back to the United States to avoid taxes. We don't stash money on some Caribbean island.
Okay, so it wasn't a Caribbean island. It was in the English Channel. Was he not telling the whole truth there in his testimony?
Well, I mean, he's being a little bit coy because when he says he pays, you know, all the taxes that they owe, I guess that's literally correct because the whole point of these tax structures is to move money, revenue, profits offshore to a place where you don't owe those taxes. So, you know, by moving a $128 billion at last count is what Apple has succeeded in basically offshoring from the United States. To places where the taxes are not owed, then yeah, I mean, he can literally say that they don't owe, you know, they don't pay any more than they owe.
So given what we know so far, how much money is the United States losing in tax revenue?
Well, it's hundreds of billions of dollars. It's really kind of difficult to calculate precisely because one of the problems here is that, look at Appleby, this particular law firm that we've been whose papers we've been examining. That's just one firm. There are hundreds of firms that provide these kinds of services. And so it's only on the rare occasion you're able to crack open the vault and kind of see what's going on with these outfits that provide this stuff. We don't know what we don't know. So, I mean, there's all sorts of corporations, multinationals in the United States, wealthy people that are using the services of lots of these firms that, many of which we're never going to find out what exactly they're up to. So coming up with a total is very difficult. I'll give you one quick example, though, of, James Simons, one of the wealthiest people in the United States. He's a big Democratic donor, by the way. He's the creator of a hedge fund that is one of the most successful in the world. In the Appleby documents, we discovered a previously unknown trust fund that he had set up. It had $7 billion in it.
Wow.
All that escapes taxation. So, if that's repeated many, many times over, then the number could be astronomical.
Wow. Well, is there a way for lawmakers to get a handle on this and to just prevent it from happening? Could they enact laws saying you just can't park your money offshore?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the debate now in Washington is about lowering the corporate income tax rate to somewhere around 20%. That really kind of misses the entire point. You can't compete with 0%, which is what some of these locales like the Cayman Islands offer when it comes to corporate revenue. So, yeah, I think until something is done about the fact that companies like Apple and Nike and Facebook, which are headquartered in the United States, are somehow able, for tax purposes, to claim that their profits are domiciled someplace else, which doesn't have a very high tax rate. I mean, that is a conundrum that the United States have never been able to seem to grapple with. I mean, there is no actual creation of anything going on in the Jersey Island where Apple has $128 billion parked. So it's hard to argue that that is a legitimate way to kind of shelter their profits.
$128 billion.
Billion with a B, yes.
Right. Okay, you've also reported on President Trump's Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross, and this is slightly confusing, his ties to the Russians. Can you make it a little simple for us and explain exactly what happened here with the shipping company he invested in?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the reasons it's confusing is it's not a coincidence that it is, because, a guy like him, his financial portfolio is very complex and not very transparent, I think, for a reason. He had invested in a shipping company called Navigator, and once actually controlled the company at one point. When he came into office, he continued to maintain investment in Navigator, although that was not immediately apparent from his ethics disclosure filings. That was something we discovered in going through the Appleby files, where he has been a client for a very long time. What's interesting about it is that among Navigator's top clients is a Russian energy company called Seabor, which is very politically connected in Russia. Among its top shareholders are President Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, and two oligarchs, one of whom is sanctioned by the U.S., and the other one has another company that is also subject to U.S. sanctions. So Navigator, which Ross has a very large investment in and once controlled, is benefiting greatly to the tune of tens of millions of dollars a year in revenue from this Russian company.
Hmm. And that was not previously disclosed. Could he be in trouble for not disclosing that?
Well, what's interesting is it was and it wasn't. He disclosed in one filing the fact that among his many assets, he had this Navigator investment at the end of 2016. But after that, when he was required to file an ethics agreement showing what he intended to divest and what he intended to keep after he became Commerce Secretary, it doesn't appear in that filing. And that's because he listed several investment partnerships they intended to keep, but those partnerships are what he uses to hold his Navigator investment.
Mm.
So the partnerships on the form don't describe what the underlying assets are, if you follow what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So he met the letter of the law, but the end result is no one realized he had this investment.
All right. Are you still digging into this trove for more stories?
Well, there's 13 million records in there, and we've spent better part of the past year, myself and many, many others, looking at this stuff. I think that this is a kind of a leak that doesn't matter how long you spend on it, you probably will never get to the bottom of everything that's there to find.
Mike McIntyre, investigative reporter at The New York Times, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the celebrity PR machine is stumbling in a post-Harvey Weinstein world, next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. This week, the Harvey Weinstein scandal took yet another turn. An article in The New Yorker revealed how Weinstein used an elaborate spying network to keep his alleged sexual misconduct out of the public eye. The story details how Weinstein hired private investigators and lawyers to discredit his accusers, as well as journalists pursuing the story. In the piece, Weinstein denied targeting or trying to silence anyone. But perhaps to a lesser degree, aggressive reputation management goes on every day in Hollywood. Behind many movie stars and other powerful people, there's a whole industry of publicists, consultants, and lawyers working to keep their clients' images squeaky clean. And right now, that machine is in a bit of a tailspin. Steven Zaitchik writes about the entertainment business for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
And also joining us, Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Madeline.
Steven, you wrote a story about Hollywood's image consultants and the crisis with them, and it begins with a story about Ben Affleck. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely, yeah. Ben Affleck, someone who's obviously one of Hollywood's biggest stars. He also has the misfortune at the moment of being very connected with Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein made his career with a number of big hits in the 1990s. He also has a big movie coming out this month in Justice League. And so I think what happened was, as the Weinstein scandal started to unfold, Affleck found himself caught in the middle. He's also had some groping allegations made against him. And so his team kind of got together and said, you know what, we are going to put together this Facebook post. He's going to apologize. Well, not apologize, really, say he's sad about what happened with Harvey, but kind of absolve himself. Totally backfired. Rose McGowan, among others on Twitter, lashed out at him and really threw his team for a loop, tried to come back and really distract from the issue with a rather amusing diversion, a story about him adopting a husky, a new dog. And that backfired, too, and everyone started to snicker. And I think what that incident to me, what it really brought home is the fact that a lot of these image maintenance types, a lot of these image consultants in Hollywood who are used to these sort of tried and true methods of sort of keeping their clients squeaky clean, whether that's social media, whether that's the tabloids, whether that's softening their image in some way, they're finding that they're not working anymore, that this machine that used to really just sort of thrum at this very efficient and noiseless pitch now seems to be thrown out of alignment, and they're not quite sure what to do.
So just lately, or I think the latest statement that he said about this whole thing is that he has been, quote, looking at my own behavior and addressing that. Is that something he was told to say then by his PR people?
You know, it's really a mix, and it sort of depends on the personality. I mean, in Ben Affleck's case, he is pretty involved in his own image management, does have a team that works with him and that they will bounce ideas off each other. But it is surprising, Madeline, there are a number of instances, far more than I think listeners will realize, when somebody says something and it seems like just this spontaneous, organic outburst of feeling, and it's all very stage managed. And I think Ben Affleck is no exception in that regard.
And then his brother Casey Affleck has had a similar situation, and yet he seems to be doing okay, even though there were a couple of lawsuits filed against him.
Casey Affleck is a fascinating test case. As some listeners may remember, he won an Oscar last year for his performance in Manchester by the Sea. And he had had, exactly right, he had had two civil suits filed against him for a movie he did in 2010. They had started to bubble to the surface. It seemed like they were gaining traction and it might actually affect his Oscar candidacy. And somehow his publicists, and you have to give them credit, they were very effective in this way. They'd kind of performed some PR jujitsu and managed to keep the allegations almost completely out of the press. You're talking about months and months of Oscar coverage, dozens of reporters who either talked to him or wanted to talk to him. And it really only started to surface at the end. And even then, it didn't affect his ability to win. So they did a very masterful job. Casey Affleck, I think if he was in the running this year, probably would not be as lucky, but they were able to keep it out of the papers last year.
And Kim, you've been on the receiving end of many of these publicists trying to shape your reporting and keep the bad stuff out. You had a particular situation when you were working with the Roy Price story. He was the head of Amazon Studios, and now he's out, and largely because of your reporting. Can you talk about how these publicists were trying to influence you in your reporting with that story?
Well, what happens in a situation like that, and we were pursuing allegations that he had made, he had harassed producer Issa Hackett of Man in the High Castle, a poor choice because she's married to a woman and she's Philip K. Dick's daughter. And in that role, she controls a lot of intellectual property, and which is very valued. So poor choice. And when you get into an allegation like that, now we're very quickly transitioning from PR to legal. So what happened was Roy Price lawyered up. It was not Amazon. It was he individually. He hired Charles Harder, who had represented Hulk Hogan in a case against Gawker that ultimately actually destroyed Gawker. Lisa Bloom, a self-proclaimed feminist and person, you know, who wants to be seen as such, they not only threatened to sue very aggressively. I mean, they were sending us registered letters and preserve all records. And they also, Lisa Bloom, repeated a fabricated story that was designed to smear me, that I had, you know, improperly and unethically tried to get money out of Roy Price. And, you know, she was told, I think, by Hollywood Reporter that you know, this was a defamatory kind of allegation, but she nonetheless repeated it to at least two other publications. So, you know, they will do what they did, tried to do with, you know, other reporters who went after Harvey Weinstein. They will investigate you. They will try to smear you. And, you know, yeah, I mean, that's why we need to behave ourselves carefully as reporters, because we don't want them to have anything to use against us.
Well, right now, Weinstein's spokeswoman is Sally Hoffmeister, and she's with a crisis management firm. It's called Citric and Company. Mm-hmm. They seem to be in the middle of a lot of these problems, these crises. Who are they, and are they part of this machine we're talking about?
Citric is a crisis manager. A lot of people are, you know, either appalled at or amazed by Sally Hoffmeister, who used to be a reporter at the LA Times, in this role, over and over again, denying that Harvey Weinstein had non-consensual sex, as he is about to be potentially indicted. So that's what they do. And, you know, I kind of joke that Citric and, on the legal side, Marty Singer, who has written us many very aggressive threat letters about people who actually turned out to have done whatever we were preparing to write that they did, you know, saying they're false and defamatory and they're going to sue us. It's almost, I feel like at this point, if you're going to Citric and you're going to Marty Singer, it's almost as saying, I probably did this.
What do you make of David Boies' involvement in this story? I mean, here's the guy who argued Bush v. Gore. Here's a guy who argued for gay marriage here in California. He's a celebrated lawyer. And he was in this Ronan Farrow New Yorker story, involved in helping or trying to help Harvey Weinstein dig up dirt on journalists, particularly the New York Times, trying to shut down the story on Harvey Weinstein, even though he was representing the Times in a different matter. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, David Boies signed a contract with one of these kind of detective slash black ops companies. And, you know, the New York Times has now dropped him because they are saying, we did not retain the lawyer with the understanding that this person would try to halt one of our stories and potentially cause people posing with false identities to interfere with our reporting. He has issued a sort of defense of himself, which, you know, whether he can parse this, that he didn't breach ethics, I don't know. You know, how lawyers can do. But in terms of perception, I think he's done himself immense damage by being a part of this. I don't understand why he was a hero in the fight for gay marriage and argued that case up to the Supreme Court with Ted Olson. And now this is going to become like the lead sentence in his obituary. So I don't know how he decided to get himself caught up in this, but I think it was a terrible idea.
Maybe he needs to hire Citric.
Exactly.
Stephen, it doesn't seem, as you say, this PR machine seems to be breaking down. When you look at Kevin Spacey, you look at Harvey Weinstein, of course, what are the PR people going to do now? Because it just seems like there is this unstoppable tide of bad news about these guys and whoever might be tarred tomorrow.
Well, it's an interesting question. And I've talked to a number of people who are in this position of having to both advance their clients' interests and put them front and center in front of the media at this point, but also try not to call too much attention to their misdeeds or alleged misdeeds. And I'm not sure that's a needle they can thread. You know, one thing that people did say to me is, look, we're not here, unlike the crisis PR people, we're not really here to talk about someone's personal life. We're here to really talk about them in the film. And on one level, I understand that, you know, that Oscar season and film promotion generally is not really a court of law. It's not really a referendum on character. That said, for one thing, practically, I don't think that, as you say, that's realistic. I think there is going to be this rising tide. I think there's this kind of woke brigade and a whole consciousness raised group that is going to be coming after anyone, as they should, who has been alleged to have committed any misdeeds. But I also think more importantly, more fundamentally, the issue here is really if you are going to campaign, and Oscar campaigns are really about pushing your candidate as worthy of an Oscar, worthy of the industry's accolades, worthy of the public's recognition. If you're going to do that, and you're going to do that on the basis of who they are, their body of work, their charm, their persona, I think it's totally reasonable for any journalist or anyone in the public, for that matter, to say, you know what, this is not just a performance I'm voting for, or a directing job that I'm voting for, or that I'm somehow paying attention to or paying money for when I go to the movie theater. This is a personality, and this is a collection of moral traits. And if those traits are found to be wanting, as they are all too often and all too sadly, then I think that's a reasonable question to ask. And I think publicists are going to have a very hard time really saying, well, look at the art, not the artist. I just don't think that flies anymore. Mm. Look, Kevin Spacey already has an Oscar bid pretty much ruined because of what he allegedly did. And I think there are a lot of other contenders who are not nearly in the same precarious position as him, who are going to find themselves out of the race very early. Casey Affleck hung in very late and won. I don't think that's going to be the case for almost anyone with any kind of question about their past.
Just turning to the Casey Affleck of it all, he's supposed to present this year, and there are petitions floating around online that the Academy should not allow it. So I don't think that goes away. And in terms of the PR, you know, this is not a possible, as Steve said, you can't thread the needle, you know, when it's did you or did you not do this act? You know, you can't say, well, yes, he did it, but it's a kind of a yes or no question. So I just don't see how you can even think about campaigning if you really have a bad allegation, especially, you know, presumably that you know that it's true, that's likely to come out. I think it's a very risky business right now.
Mm. Kim Masters, editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter, host of KCRW's The Business, and Steven Zaitchik writes about the entertainment business for The Washington Post. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Coming up, Yuval Sharon is here to talk about his new opera, War of the Worlds.
I don't think art necessarily can change the world in a direct way, but what I think it does is inspire the desire for change in the audience member. And so I hope that coming to an experience like War of the Worlds reminds people to be active in their own lives.
Mm. Yuval Sharon's modern take on Orson Welles' classic radio drama, next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times.
That's from the 1938 broadcast War of the Worlds by Orson Welles. It was a radio drama of Martians invading the Earth based on the novel by H.G. Wells. It was remade into a movie starring Tom Cruise. Now it's going to be an opera at the Walt Disney Concert Hall. Three wartime sirens will blast the music out to the streets of downtown L.A. The show is a modern take on how information is spread and how reliable that information is or isn't. War of the Worlds will run November 12th and November 18th. And director Yuval Sharon is here now. He founded the experimental opera company called The Industry. Welcome back.
Thanks, Madeline. It's great to be back.
Great to have you. Okay, so You wanted to remake War of the Worlds because?
Well, it's funny how this whole project came about. It actually started with meetings related to the last opera that I did with my company, The Industry. We did this opera called Hopscotch, which took place in cars moving around all of downtown Los Angeles. And we spent a lot of time at City Hall talking to a lot of city officials. One of them is a man by the name of Tanner Blackman, who was working at that time in Huizar's office. And he said, you know, there are these World War II era sirens that are all around downtown Los Angeles, and actually all around all of Los Angeles. There's 200 of them still up, and they are just screaming for for some sort of artistic intervention.
And still operational, these sirens.
No, they were decommissioned in the 80s, actually. So they've been silent, kind of silent relics on the street of Los Angeles. I'm sure we've all passed them a million
times. Yeah, we just
times.
Have no idea what they are. Exactly. Just think, oh, just some structure.
Exactly. They look like telephone poles, or they look very ordinary. But then you just, all of a sudden, as soon as your attention is brought to one, you start seeing them all over the landscape. Yeah. And that's kind of shocking to think about how much we don't notice these layers of manipulation in our own landscape. And that's kind of how the idea really started. Tanner was working with a company called NowArt, and they've become also one of our partners with this project. I brought this idea to the LA Philharmonic. But starting with the siren, it kind of spun out from there. How would we activate these sirens in a way that would be both artistically exciting, and then also what would be the themes and the content of bringing these kind of objects back to life?
So it was the sirens first, and then you thought War of the Worlds.
Yeah, because I started thinking about radio and thinking about radio drama and the kind of theater of the imagination that radio really inspires, that as you're listening, your mind goes somewhere. I think that's what happened in 1938 when the first radio broadcast happened. You just hear the impetus of this particular attack, and you imagine, you know, especially when it's presented so straight-faced like it was in 1938, your mind starts to race and fill in the images. And I think in our image-crazy world where we're bombarded with the visual, there was something for me really exciting about stripping the visual away and making something audio only. And for me, I think there's a current in our society now towards that deprivation of certain senses. When I think about podcasts and the popularity of podcasts and how much people actually look for those opportunities to use their own imagination instead of it being completely fed for them, the way that we see in social media or in other kind of media, I think there's something really appealing about that. And exploring that interested me greatly in developing this project. But, you know, the idea, you know, initially was that we would just be broadcasting from Disney Concert Hall out onto the street. But through these air raid sirens, yeah. That it would be like this live concert would suddenly activate these sirens on the landscape. But I became a little more interested in actually this two-way communication between the hall and the street, that there would be singers positioned at those siren sites, and those singers and instrumentalists would be broadcast back into the concert hall. So there'd be this two-way communication of hall and street. It actually fit perfectly with the idea of War of the Worlds, because the radio broadcast is a constant interruption of a musical concert with reports from what's happening elsewhere, these reports of these alien attacks and these kind of eyewitness accounts. And so I felt like actually we were able to replicate that exact experience of people at a concert hall whose enjoyment of a particular concert keeps getting interrupted with the noise and the sounds of the street.
And there might be audience members who just gather there at these air raid sirens.
Yeah, that's the hope. They're free. You can RSVP for a seat at those siren sites, and then you'll get the address right away. Right now, they're kind of a secret, so that, you know, I'm not sure the best way to really to really describe why, except that I think that element of surprise is really a big part of what we want this experience to be for people. Also, that idea that people might just stumble upon this performance happening seemed really exciting.
Yeah, that's what
to
I
me.
Was thinking.
Yeah.
And so will it be the same basic story of Martians invading the Earth?
Yes. I adapted the radio broadcast in a way that feels, on one hand, very straightforward. It takes the same exact format. On the other hand, the piece itself lends itself so easily to a kind of adaptation to our current times. The parallels are so clear to what we're experiencing with fake news, the constant manipulation of a threat from outside that seems to distract us from the threat that's really inside our borders. All of that actually felt so clear that all we had to do was present it and not necessarily underline and use a hammer to hit our audiences over the head with why we're doing this piece. I think the reasons for doing this piece will be so evident for anyone sitting and watching it.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned fake news, because not only was this obviously fake news, the War of the Worlds broadcast, but then the news that people panicked listening to it has also been debunked. And right. that's fake news, too, because right. it turns out that not that many people listened to it. Not that many Americans were actually tuned in to that broadcast back in 1938. And of those who were, many of them did not panic.
That's absolutely true. There's a great study that just came out by the writer A. Brad Schwartz, who wrote a book called Broadcast Hysteria. He writes that actually there is this extra layer of fake news. There's the fake news of the radio broadcast and the fake news of the newspapers that had it out for radio that thought that radio was going to destroy their jobs and destroy the reliability of them as journalists. If there was a panic, it seemed to have been people that really responded more to the tone of broadcasters saying with dead seriousness that something terrible was happening and people calling each other, not necessarily listening to this kind of prank aspect of it, of that it was Martians.
Because maybe they thought it was Nazis at that time.
That's the thing. Yeah, it was before America joined World War II. And so there was a lot of tension in the air and a lot of fear and anxiety. And I think Orson Welles was really after trying to show that this organ of information that people saw the radio to be as a trustworthy and very speedy servant of information was actually very fallible and very manipulable and something that shouldn't be trusted so easily, that it's still up to us to use our own critical faculties to assess whether what we're hearing is true or not.
And you like to stage your operas in unconventional places and in using the landscape of Los Angeles yeah. and that being very much a character in your work. Yeah. You mentioned the previous opera that you did, Hopscotch, took place mm-hmm. in cars around, and then it went to various landmarks in downtown Los Angeles. And then previous to that, you had an opera at Union Station. Right. So if you could talk a little bit about that and how the importance of Los Angeles's topography, if you will, in your work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel very inspired by the landscape of Los Angeles. And I think that if we invite our audiences in to this creative and highly artificial space like we're creating for War of the Worlds too, and allow people to just reflect on what it is that we're experiencing in our everyday lives, we actually inspire a kind of active attitude towards our lives, as opposed to sometimes, you know, obviously classical music is my life, so I love it dearly. But in times of crisis like ours, there is the possibility that it can cultivate a kind of passive attitude to our everyday life, that we kind of ascend into this beautiful hall and we hear these old masterworks and we suddenly think that everything is going to be okay. And we can kind of sit back, relax, and enjoy the music.
But
right?
What's wrong with that for just 2 hours?
There's nothing wrong with that, but it needs to be balanced with a heavy dose of the opposite, which is be active, be awake. And what I hope is that these kind of audacious experiments like War of the Worlds or Hopscotch or Invisible Cities, that what they do is actually inspire people to think about how art can keep opening up a window for us to say, well, maybe this thing that we thought was closed and inaccessible.
Like this air raid siren.
Right. Like the air raid siren. That kind of opens up this possibility of thinking what seemed impossible actually now is happening. And what else in our world needs that attitude, needs that sense of change, needs that sense of our creative hacking, you know, like we're doing with the sirens, you know. and that's where I think art has its greatest power. I don't think art necessarily can change the world in a direct way, but what I think it does is inspire the desire for change in the audience member. And so I hope that coming to an experience like War of the Worlds reminds people to be active in their own lives. Mm.
So is the better ticket the one on the street near the air raid siren or at the Walt Disney Concert Hall inside?
You know, if I do my job right, then all of the sites are equally great. I mean, every single site gets the same piece and the same performance. You just see it from a totally different perspective. So at one site, you're seeing this kind of army encampment. Each of the three sites also has an art installation there that's being created by the artist Calder Greenwood. That has somewhat of a visual component at those three sites. At Disney Concert Hall, you'll have more instrumentalists, as well as Sigourney Weaver, who is playing the MC. You know, all of them have, I think, something really exciting about them. My hope is that people will try to see it twice. I know it's a lot to ask for me, people to, you know, but it's only an hour. So, yeah. So, and on the 18th, they're actually at 12 and 2 o'clock. So there is the possibility to kind of make a day of it.
Oh, nice.
To see it at one spot at 12 and then see it again from another perspective at 2 o'clock. If people can do that, what I hope they get out of that is that the singularity of one experience actually has this alternative view kind of built into it. There's something about that that I really like, and I hope for an audience will be very exciting, where suddenly if they're sitting and watching a Disney concert hall and they're just hearing these voices from the street, not even sure if they're live or not. They might be pre-recorded for all they know.
Yeah.
And suddenly they go onto the street and suddenly realize there are singers there that are actually making those sounds and embodying this character. And the whole life of the street around those sirens creates, I think, an environment that, well, we'll see how that feels. But I'm very excited about what that will feel like. I'm quite different from the kind of protected realm of the concert hall. That's actually one of the things I think the piece is fundamentally about. It's a kind of ironic look of at the concert hall as the protected site, as the one that is the safest place to be in a time of crisis, that music somehow only can protect us. It's something that this piece really attacks in many ways, that the safe haven of the hall is actually being infiltrated with the sounds of the street. And I think we look at that notion of classical music and cultural institutions as divorced from reality and divorced from everyday life. We look at that very critically in this piece. And I think that the best perspective then is to try and see it from both perspectives.
Yuval Sharon, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Yuval Sharon is the artistic director of The Industry. That's an experimental opera company. You can see War of the Worlds on November 12th and November 18th at the Walt Disney Concert Hall and, as of now, at 3 unnamed locations in downtown Los Angeles. And coming up on this program, the comedian Gilbert Gottfried will be here. He'll talk about why it is never too soon to make a joke about a sensitive subject next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. You know his voice for sure.
The other day, I was in a restaurant, and I said, I want a cup of coffee. And the waiter said, how do you like your coffee? And I said, I like my coffee the way I like my women.
Okay, we're going to stop that there. You probably know Gilbert Gottfried's comedy, or at least you know that it's adult, offensive to many, over the line. You get the idea. But Gilbert Gottfried, the person, you probably don't know very much about him. A new documentary wants to change that. It's called Gilbert. And I welcome Gilbert Gottfried to our studio to talk about it.
Oh, thank you.
Great to have you. Also joining us is your wife, Dara Gottfried. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And the director of Gilbert, Neil Berkeley. Hi.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Great to have you. All right, so Gilbert, why did you want to do this documentary? What do you want people to know that people don't know already about you?
Well, the first thing that you're wrong with is wanted to.
It was imposed upon you?
Yeah. It was...
By you, Neil?
This really is because of Dara. For a couple of years, I told people I would make a Gilbert Gottfried movie, and most people would roll their eyes. And I never called his agent or tried to actually do it. And one day I was walking down 6th Avenue with this woman named Astrid Dorf, and she said, what's your next movie going to be about? And I said, it's going to be about Gilbert Gottfried. And she looked at me like I was a crazy person. And I said, what? And she goes, that's weird you said that to me because his wife is my best friend.
What?
And they live two blocks that way.
Yeah,
and we had dinner that night, and I met him the next day, and... Like 9 months later, she called and said, just come out and do it.
But why had you always wanted to do a documentary about Gilbert?
So I grew up in the 80s, and he's always part of the lexicon. You know, he's always in the peripheral. And my first movie has a Pee-wee Herman line, through line. And I got real curious about what it's like to be a comic and put this persona on and have to be like that person. And Gilbert's someone that never broke that character, and no one knew anything about him. So it just became an obsession. Like, what's he like? What's his real life like?
And you have a Pee-wee joke, right?
Oh, my God, yes.
Can
yes.
we say it you're on the radio or no?
I you know, hey, you're asking me.
How about you say it and then we'll beep it?
Yeah, so I'll say the joke and go, hey, remember that woman who used to have a radio show? I was asked to be a presenter on the Emmys. And it was right after Pee-wee Herman got arrested in the porn theater for playing with his pee-wee.
And okay, so far I still have a radio show.
And so that was all over the news. And I went on and I said, I really sleep better at nights knowing Pee-wee Herman's been arrested. If masturbation's a crime, I should be on death row.
That was racy material back then. That was hard hitting stuff.
And then I said, right now my right hand is like Superman. I could take a piece of charcoal and crush it into a diamond. And how did they know he was masturbating? Did they dust for prints?
Do you still do that joke?
I never throw away a joke. Okay? I'm still on stage going, hey, how many of you watch Bonanza?
Like 9/10 of our audience has no idea what you just
said. Except, now you know my career. You just described my entire career. But I saw it like so many times I've gotten in trouble with jokes. It's like the news takes the moralistic approach that, well, we don't want to say this, but we have to, you know.
Right. So is that what happened with the whole Affleck situation?
Oh my God, yeah.
So this was, for our audience who doesn't remember, you were the duck.
Yes.
And you were no longer the duck because of some tweets that you did about after the tsunami in Japan.
Yes.
That people thought were tasteless.
Yeah. And then it's like, it was basically me doing what I always do. They kept referring to it as his tasteless comments.
Remarks.
Yeah. Tasteless comments and remarks. And because I guess even they knew if they put the word jokes, people might think, well, wait a minute. He's a comedian making jokes? That's what the outrage is?
Right. That's his job. So, Dara, why did you... I mean, obviously, there's a lot of material here. Is that why you thought this would be a great documentary?
No. You know what? It never even occurred to me to do a documentary. And what happened was Neil came into our lives and he kept pursuing and pursuing and pursuing. And I watched his other two movies that he had made, and they were wonderful. Beauty is Embarrassing and Harmontown. And I was impressed with his filmmaking skills. And he was so passionate about doing this movie. I mean, he sent us a letter on parchment paper, a handwritten letter.
Parchment paper.
Yeah, I mean, like really nice parchment paper. You know, he just was so passionate. I'm like, you know what, Gilbert? Let's just give it a try. And Gilbert could not make a decision for the longest time. He never made a decision. He really never agreed to do it. And I finally said to Neil, I was like, Neil, Gilbert will not make a decision. I keep asking, he will not make a decision. Just show up, come for a week. If he's comfortable, then just stay. And if he's not comfortable, at least you gave it a try for a week. And let's just try it and see what happens. The next day, he was on a plane from LA and he showed up at our house and...
Yeah, I always forget there was that test week. But you look at that week, what happened in that week, there's so many things in the movie, like meeting his sister. I met his sister the first day we shot. His sister, who you meet in the movie, is this amazing photographer, this wonderful person. But it was kind of weird. The whole time I was like, do they think this is real? Because I shot it by myself. So it was always just me and a camera with headphones and hanging a lav on Gilbert, just chasing him around the world. We went to 15 cities in Mexico and Toronto. And I was the whole time thinking, I wonder if Dara thinks this is real or not, because it doesn't look real. There's no crew and lights and stuff.
It didn't really feel real. Yeah. What it felt like is, I'm glad you're on the road with Gilbert, because at least I know someone's buying him dinner.
I think the reason I'm fascinated by people like Gilbert and why comics love him and why people love to watch what he does is he's one of those rare people that is going to do what they're going to do no matter what, which is a very fearless and sometimes gets you in trouble, but comics love that. They always talk about the fearlessness of going on stage and doing and saying what you're going to say, whether it gets you fired or whether it makes you successful. And I'm fascinated by that. I think everyone wants to be like that at some way. So when you see it in Gilbert, it is like, you know, it's exciting. You want to be like that person. So that's why I was interested in it.
There's a comic in your movie. His name is Richard Kind, and he says something along those lines. Let's listen to him.
You were defiant to the audience. Nobody was laughing, and you kept going. and it was
I remember those
simply
days.
The funniest thing I'd ever seen, ever, ever. That's why I can't be a comic. That's why I can't do stand-up. I'm funny. I'll do it. But if I'm not pleasing the audience, it's me. And you are not that. You're defiant to the world. It is the greatest gift you could ever have. You just you are true to yourself. So that's why I think, that's why I admire you. It's why we all admired Lenny Bruce. Yeah. You know, it goes way back.
Wow, Lenny Bruce comparison.
Oh, my God, yeah.
There's a moment in the movie with Dick Van Dyke where they sing together. It's really pretty amazing. And afterwards, Gilbert decides to work Blue, but it's the only time, I've known you like 2 years, it's only time I've ever seen you hesitate. But if you watch the movie, you can see Gilbert like pause and in his head think, should I say this? And then, of course, he says it.
Yes. It's like I always think twice, but say it anyway.
That pretty much sums it up.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in today.
Oh, thank you.
This is so much fun. That's Gilbert Gottfried, and also Dara Gottfried is here, and Neil Berkley, and their new movie is called, the new documentary, it's called Gilbert. And you can see Gilbert here in L.A. at Lemley's Monica Theater starting tomorrow. All right, Christian Bordahl is here now.
Hey there, Madeline Brand.
Listener feedback from yesterday.
From yesterday, because yesterday we devoted the whole show to talking about that 1 year anniversary of the election of Donald Trump. And we even took people's calls, which we have not done.
The entire hour.
Yeah. We've only done that once before, which was the day after Donald Trump was elected. A lot of people called in with their thoughts. We also got a bunch of feedback. One of the really thoughtful ones was from Soraya Assar. She says, I've been politically active in the past, but like others, I've been re-energized. I moved back to a small town in Kentucky a few years ago, and it's super hard to find progressives here, but we are growing. I marched in the Women's March. I've become involved in the League of Women's Voters. I've tried to restart the NAACP here. She goes into a bunch of different things she's done. But in my area, I don't know what our future will be. I'm not hopeful. As a friend said, I can't unknow what I know now, that good Christian people harbor hate in their hearts. Trump has emboldened hate. If we don't conquer that, we'll not move from this place of hatred toward our fellow citizens. A lot of people also reacted to us having conservative talk show host John Cobalt on the show of John and Ken fame. Colony said, I'm still thinking it was tough. Glad to hear Dr. Jason Johnson bringing facts to balance John Cobalt. Phil said, please, please, please never have that KFI guy on your show ever again. He was called a nut job. But one of our callers I remember yesterday liked the fact that he was on because he felt like he wanted to hear from what the other side, as he called it, had to say.
Always good to broaden one's perspective.
Exactly.
Thank you so much, Christian Bordahl. Sure. And thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.